Welcome to day 7 of Rohatsu Sesshin. Rohatsu meaning December 8th. We will celebrate the ceremony of the Buddha's awakening this evening. Because it's not limited by time and space. At Bukokuji, where I practiced in Japan, they're sitting their last day of Rohatsu Sesshin today. It's always December 7th, their last day, and on that special Sesshin, on the last night, they just keep adding periods of zazen up till midnight. So when the clock turns to December 8th, just after midnight, they do a ceremony to celebrate the Buddha's awakening, a kind of a small ceremony, and then some people can go to sleep and some can sit the rest of the night. And then at morning service the next day, they do the big ceremony and the public comes from town and so on. And this image that's on the altar now, Shakyamuni Buddha descending the mountain, famous painting from the old days in China. And it seems that the Zen temples in Japan, at some point that became like the kind of standard Rohatsu image, this famous painting. So there's scrolls of this hung at for Buddha's enlightenment. And I don't know where that tradition came from. And it's a little bit surprising to me, because you think Buddha's enlightenment is like the big one, the big ceremony. That's when Buddha becomes like manifesting a 16-foot golden body and radiating light from every pore of his skin and so on. But this image is like a kind of bedraggled, ragged, scruffy Shakyamuni at the end of his long sesshin. He doesn't look so magnificent and radiant. He looks a little bit worn out. If you can look at the picture later, if you walk by there, and it's called descending the mountain. So it's going up to the mountain to realize awakening, and then coming back into the world. So to celebrate Buddha's enlightenment, we're actually celebrating his coming back into the world to benefit all beings. Now he's not afraid of the world of samsara anymore, because now the Buddha sees that the appearance of samsara is like a dream. Samsara is actually made out of nirvana. But it still appears to be full of suffering and worry and concern and difficulty. So walking into that dream, the Buddha has an open heart to benefit all beings. Yes?
Two good ones, two other good words.
Concern
is the other one, yeah. Does this also include the Buddha's mind? Like if we were to talk about the historical Buddha figure after he returns to this apparent samsaric world that is made out of nirvana, his worry, concern, is this still coming up for such a one? But it's just seen through.
Usually in the traditional story, it's like the Buddha is at this point so convinced that that samsara is a dreamlike appearance that that he's actually not worried and concerned anymore. Except, we might say, he's concerned about all those in the dream who think that it's not a dream and that it's not made of nirvana. It's made of solid stuff. And this solid stuff is disintegrating before our eyes, especially our body and mind. So this is distressing to the dream characters. And so the Buddha, in great compassion, joins, we might say, joins their concern to meet them in their concern. But I would understand that the Buddha is no longer concerned about himself, about his personal body and mind and it disintegrating, which it was too. That's how it works. That human body got sick and actually was in some kinds of various like physical difficulty, maybe quite strong at the end of the Buddha's life. But at the same time, we say the Buddha was completely free from dukkha at that point. So maybe strong pain, the appearance of strong pain, but the Buddha sees this pain is made of nirvana, so it's okay. Still might be, though, that the human Buddha moans, and we don't know if he moaned. Maybe Shakyamuni Buddha actually wasn't so into moaning, but we do have this one Zen ancestor who, when he was about to die, let out a great yell, a painful, agonized cry just before he died. And Hakuin Zenji, when he heard that story, as a young practitioner, was very disturbed by that story, because this is one of the awakened Zen ancestors. How could he cry out in agony like that? And sitting with that question for a long time, Hakuin had some realization at some point. Now I understand that ancestors cry, a perfect Buddha cry.
This picture of descending the mountain, I mean, there's a story also of standing in amazement looking at the tree.
Yeah.
Forth for 7 days.
Yeah.
Amazing, walking.
Yeah, that's right. That's more the, that's the actual, more historical story, like you say. And having been to Bodh Gaya, it's interesting that the Bodhi tree is on flat land. There's no mountain around there. So I think this is a kind of a Chinese symbolic interpretation. All mountains are actually the actualization of the ancient Buddhas. So they're, even what we call real mountains are actually just kind of like story-like mountains too. So, the Buddha gazing at the Bodhi tree and trying out sitting under different trees after his awakening for 49 days, I think it was. And earlier in Sesshin, when I was wasting zazen, reviewing my life story, year by year accounts, it was a nice one, nice year. I before I decided to stop wasting zazen in that way, I in that review, I noticed that since I began formal Zen practice 26 years ago, I've never missed Rohatsu Sesshin. Somehow miraculously. I missed like various other Sesshins, but somehow Rohatsu Sesshin, this would be the 26th one, and I felt happy about not missing them. In all different temples, Green Gulch and Tassajara and City Center, the one Sesshin I ever did at City Center, and No Abode Hermitage, a few, and Bukokuji in Japan, and then I remembered, well, actually I think there was 1 year in the middle there where I missed Rohatsu Sesshin. Because I was in India, I think 2000 year maybe, but at the week of Rohatsu, I happened to be in Bodh Gaya. It just was a little bit like coincidence. And I think I might have done like not a whole real sesshin, but maybe a few days of sitting under the Bodhi tree where one can still sit. And I thought how wonderful and auspicious to be here on that day. And you know, different countries celebrate Buddha's enlightenment on different days. So most do not celebrate it on December 8th. Originally it was the eighth day of the 12th lunar month. So I think maybe in China it's still, they go by the lunar calendar. So it's really like Japan and Korea celebrate it then, but not so many Japanese and Koreans hanging around Bodh Gaya at that time. A few. So one could, one could go to the Maha Bodhi Temple and sit on the grounds, and hundreds of people all day, every day, practicing meditation and devotion for Shakyamuni Buddha there. And there's a high fence around the maybe a couple of acres ground of this temple grounds with the Bodhi tree in the center and stupas from over the centuries all around. And they open it in the early morning and they close it at night. But one could also get permission from the temple caretakers to get locked inside the fence at night when they close the gate. Somehow I found out about that. Not so many people did that. But you could. You have to fill out some forms and stuff. The monk in charge is okay. And so everybody clears out and you clear in. And there were a few other people. I think maybe every night there's a few people scattered around. But it was December 7th. And I'm like, when again would I have a chance to, on the eve of Rohatsu, sit under the Bodhi tree? Who would pass up such an opportunity? Though it was cold, it's a little bit like Santa Cruz weather in that part of India. The summers get hot and the winters get cold, but not freezing. And I don't think anyone else was under the tree. People were like around the grounds, sitting, meditation. And so I had this spacious seat under the regal Bodhi tree. And I thought, I'll sit all night. Why not? What an opportunity. And it would be a peaceful abiding, no Mara around here. But in fact, Mara came to test me. As I took my seat and settled under the Bodhi tree, there's In addition to the few people that were locked into the temple grounds, there's a bunch of just stray dogs all over India. There's many, many stray dogs. And they just kind of, some of them live in the temple grounds, and it's too big. They can't clear them out, so they live there. And as the night got colder, one of these scruffy stray dogs, kind of like, you know, oozing pus and filled with the dust of the ground of India, trotted and kind of hobbled up to me and kind of plopped down in my cross-legged lap. And I thought, this is not part of this auspicious story of Kokyo sitting at ease under the Bodhi tree. So my noble mudra reached out and slid the dog just a couple feet away. You can sit with me there. The night was cold, and the dog was cold. And it came back, plopped into the lap. I repeated the gesture. The dog returned. This happened several times. And at this point, my samadhi started to degenerate. I wasn't exactly really angry at the dog, but I was frustrated. Like, it doesn't get it. It really doesn't get it. I would like you, dog, to sit over here. So I would push it a little further. The ground all under the Bodhi, there's the Vajra seat, right, where the Buddha sat, and that has another little fence, so you can't go sit on the Buddha's seat. That's a little too much. But you can sit very close to it, a few feet from it. And all around it is this, like, polished stone. It's a beautiful ancient temple, and maybe not marble, but like that kind of like glass sheen stone, kind of like terrace, you know, for 100 feet around the tree. So it was where I was sitting. So I could kind of slide this dog along this smooth stone a few feet. And each time it came back, I'd push it a little harder, and it would actually, you know, kind of curled up there. You could slide the dog. Maybe, like, it would go out, like, 10 feet. And the more forcefully I pushed it out, the more it started wagging its tail and treating this like a game, right? And it would come back even faster and, like, curl up in the lap, like, this is what we're doing now. And at some point, I started standing up and picking up the dog and kind of like like bowling almost, right? Kind of slide it down, and it would go out like 20 feet sliding along the thing and sort of spinning around. And then it would land on its feet and kind of running back. It's not easy to take your seat under the Bodhi tree.
Oh, please tell us that you finally just decided to embrace the dog.
Well, you know, at some point...
All night you guys play pushy-pulling?
At some point, there's, you know, one surrenders.
Well, did one?
It seemed like this was fruitless to try to reject Mara and kind of just put up a wall between me and Mara. So, okay, why don't you just come here and sleep on my lap? And you made your distraction. And the dog laid there and curled up. And in fact, it was like, I noticed it's kind of like having a blanket on my leg. It's actually kind of warm. It's keeping me warm. And at some point, after a while, the dog kind of got bored with that and got up and just walked away. So, it was a great lesson to me in how to practice when Mara is attacking. The more forcefully one tries to remove the distraction, the stronger it gets until we just let it curl up with us. So that was the one Rohatsu Sashin that I missed. Dogen Zenji says, after hearing about this principle that is prior to knowledge and perceptions, this being the case, intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Between the dull and the sharp-witted, there is no distinction. How nice. It's not this zazen, although sometimes it sounds so subtle and obscure that it seems like we must have to be really sharp and intelligent to get what this is about. But here Dogen's saying intelligence or lack of it does not matter. Some translations say whether you're clever or dull, there's no distinction. If you concentrate your efforts single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. So, it doesn't mean that we can be just scattered and spaced out, but it's not an intellectual exercise here. It's about effort to carefully examine our own direct experience. So it is about concentrating our effort single-mindedly. That's this kufu in Japanese, or gong fu in Chinese. Dogen uses that term a lot, which these days means like martial arts, but the actual meaning is more just like wholehearted, effortful endeavor in anything, actually. Like they have at the tea house downtown, you can have kung fu style tea serving, which just means that they don't come and like karate chop your table or something. It just means that it's like a ceremony. They come and serve the tea in this Chinese tea ceremony style with great attention and diligence. It's beautiful. If you ever go down there, you can, I think you may pay a little extra for kung fu style tea service. If you concentrate your effort single-mindedly, that in itself is negotiating the way. That's bendo, negotiating the way. We could also say this in itself is the wholehearted way. Practice realization is naturally undefiled. Going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness. So here's as usual, Dogen's constantly referencing these Zen stories. Practice realization is naturally undefiled refers to one of Dogen's favorite stories, where he got the term practice realization, shu shou. And the story is that Nan Yue came to the sixth ancestor, Wei Nung, and the sixth ancestor said, oh, where are you coming from? They often were asked that in the Zen stories. And that's one thing that we can ask ourselves in Zazen. Where am I coming from? Truly, where am I coming from? where are you coming from, Nan Yue? Nan Yue said, oh, from Mount Sung. And Huineng said, what is it that thus comes? That's another question, similar, same question, really. We can ask ourselves in Zazen, what is it that thus comes? There's knee pain here. What is it, actually, that thus comes? There's a thought of a chainsaw. What is it that thus comes? And apparently Nan Yue didn't just answer right away. He worked on that question. I think some stories say for years. That was his question. What is it that thus comes? And finally, he came to Huineng and said, I can answer you now, teacher. Huineng said, what is it that thus comes? And Nan Yue said, to say it's this misses the mark. It took me years to just be able to say that. To say it's this misses the mark. That was all he could come up with. How beautiful, how complete. What is it that thus comes? To say it's this actually misses the mark. And then Huineng said, well then, is there no practice and realization? And Nan Yue said, it's not that there's no practice and realization. It's just that they can't be defiled. It's not that there's no practice and verification. It's just that they can't be defiled by any concepts like this is practice and this is realization, or calling them this. They can't be defiled. So Dogen quotes this, refers to this story here, where he says, practice realization is naturally undefiled, and going forward in practice is a matter of everydayness or ordinariness. And that is a reference to this famous Zen story of ordinary mind is the way. Heijo Shin, ordinary mind, is the same characters here. Everyday mind, ordinary mind, which you could say it's not exactly like our thoughts that are all, you know, caught up in dualistic grasping, because that's happening every day, that's ordinary. But we could say that the actual nature of the mind that's caught up in all this stuff is ordinary. The term heijo in Japanese means ordinary or everyday, but also the character jo means continuous. Also, so it's like ordinary and always the case, like continuous. This is ordinary mind. And the story is, I'm sure many of you have heard this, but it's one of the great Zen stories. And I think the story demonstrates well the heart of the Fukan Zazengi. Where Fukan Zazengi begins, right? The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it depend on practice and realization? So this story is that Zhao Zhou asked Nan Chuan, what is the way? Same way. What is the way? Nan Chuan replied, ordinary mind is the way. And Zhao Zhou asked, should I try to direct myself toward it? So this ordinary mind we also hear is the empty space from which everything emerges, the boundless awareness that's originally perfect and all-pervading. So we can also call that boundless, spacious awareness, ordinary mind. Should I try to direct myself toward it? Jado asked. Like, should I turn the light around and look back somewhere for it? And Nanjuan says, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you'll become separated from it. Right? Because it has no location. If you try to like pinpoint it, or you direct yourself toward it, that's just duality. That's our usual duality. If you try to direct yourself toward ordinary mind, toward the way, you become separated from it. And then Jiaojiao persisted, saying, well, how can I know the way unless I direct myself toward it? It's like, if I don't direct myself toward it, it's like you could say it's all pervading, but how do I know? How do I know that this is it? Nanjuan said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Dualistic knowing, of the mind knowing something, is delusion. Not knowing, and just kind of like giving up and not even looking, is confusion or blankness. When you have really reached the true way beyond doubt, or the ordinary mind, you will find it as vast and boundless as space. How can this be talked about in categories of affirmation and negation? And with these words, Jiaojiao realized great awakening. So that story is kind of in here, in the background, in the Fukan Zazengi, through this line. Going forward in practice is a matter of ordinariness. In general, this world and other worlds as well, both in India and China, equally hold the Buddha seal, the Buddha mind mudra. In this painting of Shakyamuni Buddha, he's got his hand mudra is concealed under his robe. If you look at it later, it's kind of like this. He's walking like this, and I've heard it said that that's a kind of a artistic representation of the secret Buddha mind mudra. The Buddha mind seal is the way the Chinese translate mudra. So the Buddha mind seal, the Buddha mind mudra is kind of like this raggedy Buddha coming down the mountain, but he's got the Buddha mind seal kind of hidden for now as he comes down the mountain. Of course, he then reveals it universally to the entire universe. It's not really a secret, it's just seems to be hidden when we look for it, because we can't see it as something. If we direct ourselves toward it, we separate ourselves from it. In general, this world and other worlds as well, both in India and China, equally hold the Buddha seal, and overall prevails the character of the school, which is simply devotion to sitting, total engagement in immovable sitting. Yes. We are celebrating that this week. Although it is said that there are as many minds as there are persons, still they all negotiate the way solely in zazen. Or they all bendo, they all wholeheartedly practice the way solely in Zazen. Why leave behind the seat that exists in your home and go aimlessly off to the dusty realms of other lands? If you make one misstep, you go astray from the way directly before you. So this is a reference to the Lotus Sutra story of the, sometimes it's said the prodigal son story in the Lotus Sutra. I think that's like a kind of a Christian take on the Lotus Sutra. But the son of the king, right, who... Anyone not heard this story?
Sure.
Oh, okay, it must be told. It must be told. Because it's one of the great stories of the many great stories of the Lotus Sutra. That there's a king in a town who has a son, and one day the son, when just a young child, very young child, somehow gets lost in the marketplace in the town, and is so young that he doesn't remember how to get home, and it's a big bustling city, big enough so that he actually really never finds his way home, and nobody cares enough to take him in, so he becomes kind of like a street orphan, and kind of destitute child, and starts wandering out of that town and grows up as a kind of destitute beggar on the streets around that area. Meanwhile, he's the son of the king, right? How unfortunate. He has no idea that that's who he is, actually. He was too young to even know that. And then at some point, years later, he's begging in the streets, and the king, on top of the palace, looks down and recognizes him. Wait a minute, that's my son. Years ago, I lost. And I can't believe it. My great fortune to actually, that he came to this town again and I happened to see him. Just quick, I'll send my attendants down to go fetch him and bring him home, so that the spiffy-looking king's attendants come running towards the beggar kid, and the beggar kid thinks, oh no, they're coming to arrest me. I guess I shouldn't be begging outside the palace. And he starts running away, and they can't catch him. And so then the king says, wow, this is really, it's crazy how far this has gone. But I guess I have to come up with some skillful means to lure my child back to his true home. Because if the spiffy attendants come after him, he'll just be scared off. He's so lowly. He thinks of himself so lowly that he's scared by even the attendants of the king. But let's try this skillful means. Let's all let's get the attendants, and me too. I as the king, we'll dress up like other beggars, or at least menial laborers, and we'll go down and ask him to work for us. Let's try it out. So they go. They try this skillful means, and they approach him, and this time he's not scared off because they look more like him. And they say, we'll hire you at, we can't pay you very much, but we'll hire you at like a below minimum wage to shovel manure in the stable in the back of the palace over here. And he says, okay, I can do that. So he's hired, and he shovels the shit for year after year, and he's a good worker. And so after a few months, the ones who hired him say, well, actually, we'll promote you now to actually take care of the horses, and we'll have somebody else can shovel the manure. And so he's taking care of the horses, and gradually, he keeps getting promoted to, now he's like working in the palace kitchen, and now he's like, he's now the treasurer in the, palace, and pretty soon he's like, I don't know how soon. This is a story about the gradual path of practice, where that king's son is already the king's son, but has to build up his own self-confidence gradually. And at some point he's like actually attending the king. And it's not such a big deal anymore because, it was a gradual process. And then finally one day, the king and his son are hanging out, watching the sunset. And, king says, you know, there's something I never told you. Actually, you are my actual son. And the son is a little bit shocked, but it's like, wow, that's amazing. And he's like, now the king says, this whole palace is now your inheritance. And it's all yours. And at this point, and you're the king now. And at this point, this destitute son is like, okay, I can handle it. So, beautiful story, huh? I think it's just a great metaphor for practice. Sometimes we can't just go up to random people on the street and tell them, you are actually Buddha. They're like, what are you talking about? I'm a deluded, messed up person like the rest of us. So Dogen says, why leave behind the seat that exists in your home and go aimlessly off to the dusty realms of other lands? So this is the sudden school of Zen. It's like, we can skip that whole process if we want. And not even go wandering off and forget who we are. If you make one misstep, you go astray from the way directly before you. You have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not use your time in vain. You are maintaining the essential working of the Buddha way. So, do not use your time in vain is yet another quote from the Sandokai, the merging of difference and unity. Our translation says, for those who study the mystery, don't waste time. But it's the same line. Do not use your time in vain. The pivotal opportunity is this term, kiyo. And Dogen likes this in Dogen's acupuncture needle for Zazen poem. He says the functional essence of all Buddhas, the essential function of all ancestors. So that's these two characters. Ki-yo is like functional essence, and yo-ki is essential function. So it's this, in a way, you could say two truths. The essence, the formless, boundless, ungraspable essence, and the function, the way that it manifests in activity. So that's the same terms here. They kind of didn't, in this translation, they didn't bring it out. So we could say, you have gained the functional essence of human form. You are maintaining the essential function of the Buddha way. It's the kiyo and the yo-ki. Who would take wasteful delight in the spark from a flintstone? So I think just saying that the impermanent experiences of samsara are just like that quick, like this, a spark from a stone. It's like our life in a way. So Once we understand this all-pervading way, then who would take wasteful delight in this impermanent spark of samsaric experience? Besides, form and substance are like the dew on the grass, destiny like the dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. Same, right? It's just really, I love when we chant these words. I feel like it's really like this feeling of impermanence, right? It's after celebrating this great, all-pervasive awakening that's always available, then this is kind of like the admonition, Dogen saying, form and substance are like the dew on the grass. They're just evaporating so quickly. As soon as the morning sun comes up, they're gone. Destiny, our whole human life, is like a dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. Enjoy it. I don't think he's saying, don't wholeheartedly enjoy the appearance of this human life, but like, if we get so caught up in it that we forget the source, then what a shame. Please, honored followers of Zen, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be suspicious of the true dragon. So there's more references here, right? You maybe have heard the elephant groping story. Where it's like, it's actually in the Buddha's sutras, right? That the blind people and the elephant. So, and I think I forgot to try to look up that sutra, but I think the Buddha's talking about the Dharma, I think is the metaphor for the elephants, like the Dharma in the sutra where the Buddha mentions it. And so he's like, somebody says, well, what is this elephant like? And the one blind person grabs the trunk and they said, an elephant's like a fire hose. And one grabs the tail and says that an elephant is like a rope. And one grabs the leg and says the elephant's like a tree trunk. One grabs the big floppy ear, right, and says the elephant's like a big palm leaf. And, cause they're only seeing a part in their blindness, right? They only feel a part of it. They can't see the whole Dharma. So Dogen's admonishing us that we've long been grasping at different bits and pieces of the Dharma and think that we got the big picture. But let's open to the big picture, the true elephant. And then the dragon story is another one of those great Chinese legends of some fellow who was into collecting toy dragons, like little statues and paintings of dragons, which are popular in China, right? So he had this big dragon collection. He had like shelves of all different styles of model dragons and scrolls of dragons and painted dragons. He was like a dragon aficionado. And one day, an actual dragon heard about this guy who collected dragons, and he's like, that sounds cool, I want to see this guy's dragon collection. And the true dragon actually came down from the sky and stuck his head in the window and his tail in another window and started curling through the guy's house and checking out his dragon collection. And when the guy saw the real dragon, he just fainted. So, in a way, very similar to the elephant story. It's less maybe about, instead of being, we're getting different parts of the elephant, the dragon story is maybe more like we have these model ideas of the true Dharma. We have these paintings of true Zazen. When real Zazen comes, do not be suspicious of it.
When I've been hearing this section, I think you know, grasping at an elephant in different ways, and then discovering it's a dragon.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You could combine it like that, yeah. You could, yeah, right. When we take off the blindfold, it's actually not an elephant at all, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's a elephant trunked, elephant footed, elephant tailed dragon. True dragon. Or we might, yeah. Or we have an elephant collection. And then when the real elephant comes in, we see it's actually a dragon. Yeah, so it's in one line here, it's like mixing metaphors, it's like mixing two different stories. But it's sweet because the stories are very similar. Long accustomed to groping for the elephant, now don't be suspicious of the true dragon. Devote your energies to a way that directly indicates the absolute. Revere the person of complete attainment who is beyond all human agency. So that's a quote from Yongjia's Song of Realizing the Way, Song of Verifying the Way, the Shodoka. Yongjia was a very short, short-lived disciple of the sixth ancestor. So he's called the overnight guest because he came to the sixth ancestor and had one conversation and had a kind of like understood how it all is, and then just stayed one night and left. But then wrote this great poem that became one of the Zen classic poems. The beginning of the poem, the Song of Realizing the Way, goes, have you ever met someone seasoned in the way of ease? A person of complete attainment who is beyond all human agency? Who neither rejects thought nor seeks truth? The real nature of ignorance is Buddha nature itself. The empty illusory body is the very Dharma body. So the real nature of ignorance, or samsara, is Buddha nature itself. The empty illusory body, like the flesh and blood body, is the very Dharma body. Really like celebrating non-duality of appearance and reality. And it goes on for pages like this. It's a beautiful poem. When I looked at that reference, I thought, maybe in the future that's something we could look at. And beyond all human agency, I think it's a kind of clunky translation. It's in Chinese, this is wu wei. Japanese mu'i, but wu-wei, maybe familiar with from Taoism, is literally means like non-doing. But that doesn't mean like not moving or doing anything. It means like truly non-doing is like uncontrived activity. Doing without any like contrivance or effort to try to do anything. Natural doing is wu-wei in Taoism. So we could say like revere the person of complete attainment who is just uncontrived activity. Yes?
Yeah. Is it kind of similar? Could you do like doing, not doing? Or like a non-doing? Is it fair to take a bunch of these words that are like thinking, not thinking, and put a non or a trans?
Let's see. What are you doing? I'm doing, not doing. How do you do not doing, non-doing? In a way, it's a little different than turning the light around exercise. But in fact, I think it does work quite nicely in its own way, right? Doing, not doing, yeah. Wei, wu wei.
Yeah. I think of what, I'm sorry, one quick thing. Kathy was saying the other day about will and how there, you know, in some way there's, it seems as though there's like an effort put forth.
Yeah.
Or the willpower of the meditator.
Yeah. Like yeah.
Could you say something similar about that? In that there's like a will, not will?
Yeah. Effortless effort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and of course, this Fukan Zazengi has a lot of statements about Gong Fu and the wholehearted way, and you know, wholehearted, diligent engagement in Zazen. So it's not a kind of passive, lazy activity from Dogen's point of view. And we could say, what is that? What is that? But we could also say like it's this effort and energy and diligence, but without like a kind of a future goal and without expectation of a future result. It's effort for its own sake. Again, in the Zazen Shin poem, Dogen says Zazen is effort without desire. So, It's effort, but without a future result, which is unusual because most of our efforts are directed towards a future result. Yeah.
You know, the Tao Te Ching refers to Wei Wu Wei. The ancients went about doing non-doing.
Yeah. That's probably the origin of the term in Lao Tzu's earliest foundation of Taoism. Yeah. And of course Zen got kind of all blended in with Taoism. Interestingly, I think, and it may be just coincidence that this Wu Wei, literally like non-doing, but the Wei can means doing, and it also means like making. Which sound are quite different in English, but Chinese is sometimes like that. It says two meanings. So when the translators from India to China wanted to translate the Sanskrit asamskrita, which means unconstructed or uncompounded, like nirvana is an unconstructed dharma, they translated it as wu wei, which in that case I think means more like not made. It's not made. But maybe I'm sure they knew, of course, that was this Taoist term about a non-contrived activity. So it might have been a kind of just a clever nuance of way of translating asamskrita. Yeah.
Just a little commercial that our Sangha member, Sally Adiri, who does our Zen and the Arts, has arranged for this calligraphy master to do a workshop, and she says that is his skill, according to what she's experienced from him. It's really kind of dropping any ego or self out of the making or doing of calligraphy. It's not even formal calligraphy, it's you know, putting something down on paper.
Doing without doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, without, you know, it'd be another way to maybe talk about this is, we could say without expectation or a future result in mind. We could also say without a separate self, getting involved, like the self, especially the self judgment and assessment that we're like is usually when we're making effort. We usually the more effort we're making, the more self critique is involved. Seems like. So this is making this great effort, but with no, if we totally mess up, that's also okay. That's this kind of effort. Hard, I think, to not even fall into either the extreme of like, well, we don't want to get self-judgmental, so let's just not try too hard on one hand, or let's try really hard, but then not to be self-judgmental. accord with the enlightenment of the Buddhas, succeed to the legitimate lineage of the ancestors' samadhi. Constantly perform in such a manner, and you are assured of being a person such as they. Another reference to this Dogen reference earlier, when he said, if you want to attain suchness, you should practice suchness without delay. Or more literally, if you want such a thing, you should practice such a thing without delay. Coming from that Zen story of, if you want to be such a person, you must realize such a thing. Since you are already such a person, why worry about such a thing? That's the original story. So here, again, Dogen's referring to that when he says, constantly practice in such a manner, and you are assured of being a person such as this. Oh, constantly perform in such a way, and you are assured of being such a person. Your treasure store will open of itself, and you will use it at will. Your treasure store, treasure storehouse or treasury is sometimes the, when they translate Tathagatagarbha or Buddha nature, they say like the Buddha storehouse or the Buddha treasury is, it's this character in Chinese. It will open of itself, and you will use it at will. And this is Juyu. So we have Jijuyu Zamai. This self, literally the self receiving and using samadhi. Or the naturally received and naturally used presence is the Jiju Zemai. So Juyu means receiving and using, a little bit like essence and function. And as a compound in just in Chinese, apart from Buddhism, when you combine receiving and using together, they mean enjoyment. That's very cool thing, part of the language there. That the one way of talking about enjoyment is you combine receiving and using. And that is like enjoyment or also fulfillment.
Yeah,
you can have your cake and eat it too. And offer it to everyone as well. So we say the self-receiving and employing samadhi, or the self-enjoyment samadhi, or the self-fulfilling samadhi are all accurate translations. And so here, this translator skips the receive part, because the characters here are actually Juyu. Juyu Nyoi. So we could say, your treasure store will open it of itself, and you will receive and use it at will, or your treasure store will open of itself and you will enjoy it at will or as you wish. Nyoi is the last lines. Nyoi. This is called a nyoi, or in Chinese, ru yi. It means as you wish, as you like. And it's used like the wish fulfilling jewel is the nyoi jewel, that as you wish, whatever you wish comes forth from the wish fulfilling jewel. And this is like as you wish, as you like. It's one of these Chinese things that it was not originally Zen. It was, I think, originally maybe emperors, or maybe before that. And I think this is the original style that it came from. It's a lingji mushroom. Mm.
Reishi.
Reishi in Japanese. which the rei or the ling means like spiritual or mystical or magical even, and she means mushroom. But do you know about these lingji mushrooms? Because Andrew's a Chinese medicine practitioner, and they're big in Chinese medicine.
I don't know if they're so big in Chinese medicine, like in Santa Cruz, but there are hospitals I've heard of in China that use the reishi mushroom to help people, like AIDS patients who are recovering, to try to build up T cell count. It was long revered as the mushroom of immortality. It has a lot of really like hepatoprotective, liver benefiting functions to it. Enhances the immune system. It's supposed to be a sedative for the nervous system. So it's got a whole lot of really pleasant functions.
One of those kind of like tonics that just balances everything.
I think so. Yeah, adaptogenics.
They have them at the the food bin, yeah, the herb room, I guess is where they have them, yeah. They look kind of like this. And then later it became more and more stylized, right, and this is more like almost realistic lingji mushroom, and then this part became flatter, and the stem became straighter, and what we call kotsu now, those Zen stick that's on the back of the altar, has just a little curl at the top. But I think this is the origin. Is it? Your treasure store will open of itself, and you will receive and use it as you wish.
That's interesting. I was at the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco maybe like a month or two ago, and I saw one of these. It's something like it.
Yeah,
the wish fulfillment wand.
Yeah.
And maybe it was used like that for, people or children who ascribe to such a thing. But that's where the use it as you wish.
Yeah, wish fulfilling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see them around like Chinatown and stuff too. People I think often don't carry them around. They're just more like in a on display in one's home or something as a kind of like talisman or something.
Yeah.
But then somehow it seeped into the Zen world.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're more closely related to fungi than we are to plants. It's like close relative.
Huh.
That's why it has effects on
interesting, yeah.
So it's an ancestor.
And I think I've heard also that the largest living thing in the world is a fungi, because they spread under the ground, and like it's all like actually all one organism, and then it pops out on the surface in different places, but underground it's all completely connected. And there are all kinds of interesting things they do. Yeah, we know that they're not quite animals and they're not quite plants, right? They're their own category, as they wish. The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? Our treasure store will naturally open of itself, and we can enjoy it as we wish. We dedicate the narrative of our Rohatsu Sesshin exploration of the way and our devoted sitting to all beings, animals, plants, and fungi throughout the universe. May they all dance together in the inconceivable spaciousness of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.